Mining Web Weekly, Episode 3. Peter Major, Director of Mining at Modern Corporate Solutions. As ever, our man to open up our eyes and provide insight into the big moving news of the past week in the mining sector here in South Africa and around the world. Well, Peter, from your background, I can see you're still in the United States, still doing silver mining, are you?
Well, Alec, we're actually doing as much gold as we are silver right now. We got two operations here. One's a silver mine, silver, lead, zinc, and the other is a gold mine. And I've never been in love with gold, except in South Africa. There you can see the gold, you know, it's flat, it's a tabular deposit, it's like a coal bed. You drill a couple holes in your corners and you put one in the middle and you know you got a billion tons. Here, it's even if you see the gold, it's spotty, it disappears. Sometimes you're staring at a vein with nothing in it. Other times the gold's in the sidewall and you can't see it. You know, silver, lead, zinc veins are easy to follow. Your mother could do it blind. But the market wants gold. The U.S. has a lot of gold. We found out the world has a lot of gold at these kind of prices. And so if you're in mining now, you got to be in gold. And there is a plethora of people now waking up. I think the Americans are waking up to gold later than most of the rest of the world. So it's a stampede.
Why are they only waking up now?
I think just come here. Well, if you've been coming here the last 30 years, you know, gold took off again in 2004, but because Americans kind of got disfavored during the fall from the 80s and the 90s, and we know this is the tech kingdom of the planet, right? So you've got tech left and right, you got media, you got artificial intelligence, and mining in the world today on the listed side is not very big. Well, in America, it's infinitesimal. And so I think that's a lot of the reason. It was just a small part of their stock market, a very, very small part of their economy. And it's really just taken off. I'm not kidding. The last year or so, I think, in my view.
So is my former cricket captain from university, Mark Bristow, is he a famous guy now in America, now that he's running Barrick?
You know what? They make casual reference. Yeah, we've even got a South African running Barrick. Barrick still seems to be perceived as a Canadian company, funny enough. But yeah, on the whole, I think they like him. I think Americans do appreciate tough guys, and Mark is tough. Look, anybody that's been mining in South Africa and Africa has got to be tough. And Mark, he's not just been mining there. He was the first person I know, first mining company that was building a mine in Mali back in the mid-90s. And Mark's, he's gone the full plethora. My knowledge is he started with Brett Kebble. That was a real school of hard knocks. And he was building mines from the day I remember him being with Brett Kebble's companies. You know, he was building mines from scratch. So you've always got to respect somebody who's done that, built a mine from scratch, not taken over a CEO role. And he's inherited mines, and now he's buying and selling and trading. So, yeah, Americans, they do appreciate him. His rival is Newmont, and I think Mark can take on Newmont. Newmont was the parent of Anglo American. They've got great assets, maybe too many assets, whereas Mark's trying to consolidate his. And I think we know Newmont is run by a South African now as well.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
Well, she used to run Anglo-American Platinum. She used to work for Lonmin. Natasha Viljoen.
Extraordinary.
Pretty extraordinary, you're right. Two biggest gold companies on the planet by far, pretty much run by South Africans.
And based in the United States. So
it's
all just before we leave Mark Bristow, the story in Mali, have you got any update there? Because last we heard the junta, the military coup takeover, the guys arrived at the Mali mine owned by Barrick and just started carting away gold.
They did, and it's not over. I can't think of the word right now. It's it's that's exactly what's happened, Alec. Yeah. People aren't making this up. They're not exaggerating. That's exactly what's happened. The people I know that are kind of in the know, they tell me Barrick stood up the hardest, but they were the biggest. And I can see why they stood up. Lots of reasons why Mark stood up, because he built those mines from scratch. He was the first big investor in Mali. And his actions should speak louder than words. This junta that's in power now, a little bit like our government, they are desperately in power. They are clinging to power. And they do have outside terror forces trying to take them on. So it may not be as personal as we think. It's just sheer desperation. They just need money to combat groups that are actually similar to them that want to topple them and take over the country. So, hey, if you're a mining investor, you don't care what the reason is. This is a shakedown, right? They're coming up with these giant tax claims. And those could be partially true. But also what I've been told is they've got a couple, do we say, outside French investment types that they lend an ear to. And these consultants tell the junta, oh, you guys are getting ripped off. You're so freaking stupid. The company's not paying nearly the tax. This is how much money they're really making. This is how you guys are turning a blind eye to it. So it's easy to influence someone who doesn't really know their job, as we see in South Africa all the time. You know, we've got more consultants than probably any country on the planet because we have too many ministers and DGs and all these various government departments that don't really know what's going on. So even if they're well-intentioned, they can be negatively influenced by the wrong people. So I think Mark's got a couple problems there. He's got a government that is under siege, that's run by people that are inexperienced, that are inclined to listen to whoever sounds like they've got a good story at the time. Yeah, how do you negotiate with someone like that? And also, these people have proven they take hostages first, then they make demands. And boy, you virtually have to cave in. And most of these other mining companies did. And Mark knows from experience, if you've caved in to one of these demands once, if you admit, yes, my tax was incorrect, well, boy, then they'll hit you again and again, whether it was true or not. But the other companies didn't feel that secure. They didn't want to have people spending all their time in jail or house arrest. And with the gold price running, you always want to just get back to production. That's how we used to negotiate with the unions, right? And the suppliers. We just want to get back to production. So it's not resolved yet. And I don't think it's going to be resolved easily. But Barrick seems like the last one to not have 100% resolution and get back to work.
And I guess you're not surprised, given Mark Bristow's background and the fact that he built Randgold Resources, as you say, from the Kebel camp into a fabulous company, and as a result became, with that acquisition, the CEO of Barrick. But moving on to another gold company, but this one that's actually investing in copper. We got the green light this week for Harmony Gold's investment into copper. Interestingly enough, not Africa, where there's a heck of a lot of copper, but Australia. What gives?
Well, first of all, when I hear one of our guys invest in Australia, I just get hackles on the back of me. And nothing personal against the Australians, but in mining, they know their stuff. And we see all the rivalry with rugby and other about Australia. So I worry that we've had more lemons in Australia because they're not going to sell you their gems at a good price. So I always approach that with caution when I see a deal done in Australia. Now, Gold Fields has done okay there. Anglo Gold, both of them, they've done okay there. So it's all about using your wits, your knowledge, your experience to evaluate what am I buying? Am I bullish on it? Am I not bullish? And that's a lot of it. You know, you could buy a dud gold asset, Alec, as you well know. But if you buy it at 2,000, say you bought it at an overpriced, say, it was discounting 2,500. So you look like a real Wally. But if the gold price goes to 35, all of a sudden you look like a hero. Now, on the copper assets, I probably like the Australian copper assets that they've recently bought for $1 billion. I like them more than the previous ones. I think the EVA that require a lot more work. You know, they require capex, and they're lower grade from what I've seen. So, you know, that acquisition, I was not in love with at all. I didn't like it at all. This one, you know, I work out the numbers. Okay, they're paying $1 billion, but it's already producing 40,000 tons a year of copper. So let's be extravagant. Let's say copper's averaging 10,000 a ton, because it's close. It's 9,800. So, and let's say they've got a net profit margin of 25%. So they're getting a yield of about 6%. You know, you get a yield of 5% on a U.S. long bond. So to me, that's not a great deal. It's not a bad deal. You know, at least they're getting paid interest on that $1 billion they're spending. But it's a gamble on the copper price. You know, if copper stays here, I think they'll get their money back, but it's going to be long term. If they expand, they get it back quicker. If copper goes up, they're going to look like a hero. But if copper falls, it's going to look like $1 billion. I don't think it's going to be a lemon or along the lines of Stillwater Sibonia. You know, that was gross overpayment on a commodity that was already grossly, insanely expensive. But yeah, it's diversification. And it's tragic that South Africa has forced our companies to be so desperate for diversification out of the country when, as we know, Anglo American had magnificent diversification in the country for 80 years. JCI, Goldfields, Gencore, Anglo Vol. We got lots of diversification right in South Africa. Anglos had it in Africa until they had most of their mines nationalized. So to survive in this world, you have to diversify regardless of your government. But our guys seem to be doing it at a higher price with more desperation because of our government.
It's an interesting point that you make there about Sibanye as well, because the investment that Neil Froneman made into the United States, into palladium, when they bought Stillwater at the time, there were a lot of people who were waving flags and saying, hang on a minute, this does appear to be significant overpayment. And of course, the palladium price didn't help him either.
Yeah, that's a fact of life. Stillwater's been expensive since I was in college in the 70s. And we've seen a plethora of people buy it. The Russians paid a crazy price for it. I never thought they'd get out, but they sold it for an even crazier price. But, you know, as a mining company, you don't want to get into buying and selling. Every time you buy and sell, you're leaving money on the table. There's transaction fees. There's friction. You want to buy an asset. How did Anglos, we've said this before, how did they beat the index for 90 years, Alex? It wasn't buying somebody else's asset and then selling that asset onto somebody else. You know, that's desk trading, and traders all lose money in the end. So Anglos beat the index because they would start from scratch. Assets that they'd acquired or they'd picked up, and most of it was farmland. You know, they really picked it up at the grassroots, and that's how they developed such a good team. They wrote the handbook on how to make money on project startups, get the thing running. It's maybe three quarters of its planned production. Then you float it on the market, and the market gives you 70-80% of the credit for full price. But mines are still trying to do it, but they're so big now. You know, for Barrick, can you imagine Barrick and Newmont finding properties and developing them? I worry our big mining companies, they've lost that ability to do it. You know, Anglos could do it because they'd started small, grew up, and they'd repeated that pattern for decades and decades. Now, Newmont's kind of done it. They're as old as Anglo American, but geez, they've gone through crazy hedging strategies. They've gone through missteps, like in Mali. I won't call that a misstep, but Newmont's gone through it. Barrick has. It's tough. You know, the startups are still the guys where you can make 10 times your money, but boy, then you're picking in a barrel of wannabes, you know, like trying to choose IT companies in a dot-com boom. How do you know if you're going to get the right one till it's too late or you look back?
Even trying to pick AI companies in an AI boom. It's you got NVIDIA and Palantir, fine. If you're outside of that, who knows? Who knows where you could end up? But just staying with Sibanye, results out as well from Sibanye. A 19 times growth in their headline earnings per share. That tells you that the world has changed for them, that's for sure.
Look, there is a little bit of funny accounting in there. And also, our government and our unions, they're great at grabbing a company that has results. Says, look, profits tripled, and they're only offering us a 7% increase. Okay, inflation's 4, but still, you know, a single-digit increase, and their profits are up 1,000%. And we all know that is such hogwash. You know, that is so smoke and mirrors. I don't care what your profits are up until I see how high were your profits already. And was that on a decent margin? You know, you could have a billion-dollar company that made $100 profit. And maybe it made $1,000 profit. Oh, so the headlines are going to say your profits are up tenfold. You know, what percent of revenue are your profits? What is your margin? But this is outside of mining. But profits, this is what scares me about the U.S., Alec, is your percent of profits relative to market cap. That kind of has a mean reversion. But if you look at the profits and the earnings in America, it is literally two standard deviations out of a mean. It's just, it's through the ceiling. And when companies are on the highest margin they've ever made, when they've, and their profits overall are the highest they've ever been, can it just keep going up? You know, it keeps going up until it can't go up. And boy, there's always a reversion on companies' profit margin, because if everybody's making a fat margin, then somebody else is going to come in to your business. You know, they're going to say, gee, we want to join that business as well. But our mining companies, hey, it's really the golds that are shooting out the lights. It's really the golds that have gone ballistic, and nobody has a clue where they're going. I mean, that gold price, as long as that gold price is moving, these companies deserve to move their, like, they're going up. And their costs are accumulating quickly. So if gold levels for a very long time, those ratings and those company share prices will come off. But if gold price comes off, then heaven forbid, the companies will fall multiples of what the gold price falls.
Peter, you spend a lot of time in boardrooms and talking to executives. How are the guys at Gold Fields Limited now thinking about Sibanye, given, okay, it's a long time since they hived it off, but the South African gold mines are what have really given Sibanye the turbo boost in, certainly in this most recent times. Do they ever have seller's remorse and say, damn it, we should never have sold there? Or do you think, given what's happened in South Africa, they're just happy to be out?
Look, I'm not in boardrooms as much as I used to be. And I'm not talking to the CEOs as much as I used to be, because I'm busy trying for our company, for myself, to get a couple of our CEOs to be head of a real company instead of a project. But no, all my chats with Gold Fields and the people that are close to it, there's no remorse there at all. And it's sad, but it's true. And if I was them, I also wouldn't have remorse, Alec, because this gold price at these kind of levels was totally unexpected. But South Africa, unfortunately, has continued on the trend they've been on for 33 years. You know, we just see it with Gwede Montash. It's like Gwede's saying, okay, you've taken one of the legs out of the revolution, the struggle. You seem to have made friends with the union. You seem to be making realistic settlements with the union. So I'm going to have to double down with you guys on the government side. And that's what he's doing with this MPRDA. That's what he's doing with all these mining bills. He's gone from crazy to lunatic. And so any mine that's left South Africa doesn't regret it, unfortunately, because the infrastructure continues to deteriorate. The crime and the anarchy continues to increase. There's no increase in foreign investment, and the government is not changing their dogmatic view of legislation and regulation. I honestly don't think Cyril or Gwede or any of them can actually believe that more punitive legislation is going to help the country, let alone the workers. I can't believe they would believe that, not after 33 years of trial and error. So, yeah, until that changes, no, there's no regrets leaving. And that has been an engine. Those wore out assets that are in need of CAPEX, you know, you need CAPEX to extend those old mines. They're mining so far from the shaft, and they're not spending that because they don't anticipate a future in South Africa. But they have really generated the earnings. The platinum mines for Sibanye in South Africa generated. The gold is generated. I worry it's its dying last breath.
And it doesn't have to be that way. I want to give you a little bit of good news, maybe, perhaps. Maybe I'm just clutching at straws, but Gwede Montashe was kicked off the SACP Central Committee. Kicked off it, which is one thing in the right way. And the second thing was Cyril Ramaphosa is not present in China at the moment with all that, with the North Koreans and the Iranians and everybody, it seems, who hates America and hates Trump is there at the same time. He didn't go. So I don't know, Peter, maybe I'm clutching here, but perhaps some sanity is prevailing, economic sanity. I don't want to talk politics because we don't know, you know, what's going on in people's minds on political ideology, but certainly economically, we have been on a crazy trajectory. Perhaps, just perhaps, there's so much trouble going on in South Africa that the penny is dropping.
I think it's dropping in a couple ways, Alec. If Cyril was going to miss a BRICS summit, this wasn't the one to miss. You know, this is an historic one, and he could have got a lot of good out of it for the country, for South Africa. But because he's been so antagonistic to America and in their face for so many years, he almost had to miss this one, or I just worry what America would have done to South Africa. So you're right. I give him kudos for missing this one, but had he not been so pro-anti-America in all these previous years, he probably could have gone to this one, got a lot of good out of South Africa. Sorry, got a lot of good for South Africa out of it without antagonizing America too much. But yeah, because he'd painted himself in that corner, he did have to miss this if he wants to keep any hope alive for America. And thank heavens he did miss it. And Gwede Montashe getting kicked off. Look, I'm sure his own party realizes this guy's not helping us in any way. You know, even the most fervent communist and anti-business person in South Africa has got to realize Gwede's doing tremendous damage just being related to mining. And so maybe the penny's going to drop just because, what do they call it? The dead hand. Well, the dead hand of the ANC, that hand is dying, and it's just not unable to hold on to these kind of positions and people much longer, you know, because its blood supply and its oxygen supply is shrinking. And whether it wants to let go of them or it's going to have to let go of them, it has to let go of them. Otherwise, not only the ANC is going to die, but it's taking the country with us. But I think it's gotten so bad and the ANC is under so much attack that there's cracks appearing. Yeah, I can see light coming. It doesn't mean investment's coming, but investment needs to see these cracks. It needs to see these edifices start falling and these dangerous, horrible, powerful players that have been ruining. Politics does dictate what business is going to do. We can't grow economically until politics comes halfway right.
How powerful is Gwede Montashe?
He's pretty powerful, not just in the South African political sense. He's our mining minister. And he could easily get rid of this negative legislation. And what gets me, Alec, is not only is he not trying to get rid of the bad mining legislation, but he keeps proposing and spearheading new, worse mining legislation. That's what really, really irks me. Instead of being dogmatic, saying, oh, I don't want to reverse any legislation, but I realize I made a mistake here, I'm not going to put on more. But he is doubling down. Like, David Mackay says, it's always a doubling down. If Gwinnie gets one door closed on him by the Constitutional Court or the High Court or the Chamber of Mines, the Minerals Council, if they take him on some of his negative legislation, he seems to find out another door he can come in and double down with even worse. So he's darn powerful. He leads a charge. And we said long ago, when he bragged up at one of the indabas at Bernard Holt's in Joburg, 3-4 years ago, he quietly bragged up that he dropped the BE requirement for exploration prospecting rights, licenses. And yet, he didn't tell anybody about it. It wasn't in the Government Gazette. He just said, well, did you see it? No, it's not in our latest proposal. That means it doesn't exist. Well, Gwinnie, why not just say, yeah, we've taken it out because we realized it was a mistake and it drove away investment. You know, why not just say that? And why not enforce it through your branches? You're the minister. You got 9 provinces with DMR branches, but it's not enforced there. They're each their own little fiefdoms. So in a way, he's powerless with his own people, and yet his power to business is still very strong via his negative legislation and policies.
What's going on in Zimbabwe in mining? And this is a pretty appropriate question right now, because Cyril Ramaphosa was in Zimbabwe this past week and apparently fulsome in his praise for what's going on there, strangely. How's the mining sector in that country?
It's really struggling. They're finding all kinds of ways of getting around legislation. They're much more creative than we are down here, probably because they're much more desperate, because they've got 80, 90% unemployment, and because they've killed almost any foreign business except mining, that they've had to be creative to keep what foreign mining they've got, to keep the forex. You know, other than some agriculture, it's mining that brings in their foreign exchange. So I don't see that they're changing any of their legislation or reversing it. They're just not enforcing it, or they're coming up with creative ways, officially and unofficially. It's really a Byzantine structure. It's a Byzantine freaking country, if you look at it on the mining side. And it, you say, is this what dogmatism does to people? That they know it's wrong, they know it's bad, they know it's hurting everyone, even including themselves, and they don't want to back up. But I guess we see that in Putin, huh? What's going on? There's no real news I know, Alec. People tell me it's business as usual. You know, they smile, they wink, but the generals run the place. Mnangagwa doesn't. The generals run the place, and they've run it for decades. And it's like Burma. They're not going to let go. You know, maybe they got to kick a few generals off the table because there's not as many goodies to go around. But yeah, rich country in minerals. It's a miniature South Africa in its plethora of diverse minerals. They're shallow. They're easy to get. The grades weren't usually as good as in South Africa, but the mining costs were so low. But maybe there's something brewing that I don't know about, but there's no change that's going to benefit mining that I've seen politically or administratively.
Well, they certainly are trying from the political side to suck up to Donald Trump. There's no doubt about that. And I guess if you look at what's going on in Venezuela with the warships going there ostensibly to take on the drug lords, I'd also be sucking up to Donald Trump if I was in their situation. Mm. The big story closer to home, though, is diamonds. Botswana, diamonds. In the news this week, that the Botswana economy is under a lot of pressure, being so dedicated or so reliant on diamonds, and diamonds it seems to be one bad bit of news after the next.
It is, and I'm worried that the government doesn't appreciate the situation, because when I see news headlines, we've already hired Lazard and other well-known consultants to look at us taking over De Beers. I think, mama mia, you know, that government's got debt. And as you said, the majority of income in that country comes from diamonds. Now, how many governments have we seen take over a mining company and they do better? You've got to really, really dig. You know, what are the odds? 1 in 10, probably at best, that a government is going to take over a mining company and make it better and is going to know how to run it better than a company that's run it for, what, 90 years? And look, Botswana negotiated hard. And each time they came away from the table with more, and De Beers came away with less, which meant I thought the government was getting a better and better deal. I thought De Beers was caving in too much, but they probably thought, like most mining companies do, I just want things to continue. I don't need a big stoppage now. So I thought the government had a very good deal. And De Beers, they're capitalists. They want to make money. Their shareholders want to make money. They're not doing things to lose money. They're doing things to preserve capital, to keep from losing money. Yes, those are rich assets, but could anybody run them better than De Beers and run them longer and more stable? You know, De Beers had a balance sheet that they could keep those Botswana assets going when they would close assets elsewhere. And they would put, they committed a lot of money into Botswana education, trades and industries away from diamonds. So I don't know, but I just think maybe the government should be at the bidding table, but they better have somebody behind them who can really run these. And it better not be somebody new who thinks they can run them, who wants to run them. You know, it was their childhood dream. I just think that government doesn't have the kind of balance sheet, let alone the technical expertise to be running diamond mines. And these are big mines. And what are you going to do? You're going to increase production and flood the market. And this market is touchy, as governments only belatedly are realizing, like the South African government. Remember when they came out with this new mining act, Alec, in 2004, you had to have 26% BEE for all mining companies, except diamonds. They said diamonds are special. Diamonds, you have to have 51% BE. You know what? If they had a clue about how risky diamonds were, they would have said, diamonds are special. You don't have to have any BE for diamonds. You know, we just want you to develop them because they're probably the riskiest and most difficult of all commodities. But that's how greed and ignorance together equal a train smash. So Botswana, they're skating on thin ice here. I can't see them buying that. Where are they going to get the money? Where are they going to get the expertise?
Yeah, it's such a pity that governments don't do their sums and have a look at, well, this is what we get on royalties. This is what we get from taxes. Let's bring them in here and maybe learn from other governments, maybe learn from the Middle East, learn from some of the governments in South America who bring in the oil producers, who fund everything in those countries, and now they want to take it over because they think they can run it better, which they can't, and that they'll make more money out of it, which they won't. So it's a really, really sad situation that you allow Dunning-Kruger syndrome, where people who know the least think they know the most. If only they do a little bit of research on that one. But coming back to South Africa and the Glencore story this week with Ferrochrome and its joint venture with Merafe. I had a look at the Merafe share price. It hasn't collapsed. So presumably they got other assets that they're relying on. But this Ferrochrome, 5 smelters, four are in mothballs, 1 left, and that one now looks like it's going to be closed as well.
Boy, we touched on this last week, and I cry because I think of the Leviathan South African ferrochrome producers were when I came here in the 80s. And they were there through the 90s like that too. We had most of the world's known chrome. And we had converted it to ferrochrome. There were countries that had richer chrome than us. But because we had great infrastructure, great weather, decent mining legislation, real economic coal, and the cheapest electricity on the planet, virtually, made from waste coal, we could produce ferrochrome that the world could not keep up with. And we know that was an add-on, that was beneficiation, that was great for the country in so many ways. And now we've removed almost all those competitive edges. And I won't say permanently removed, but there's very little trace of those competitive edges, and they cannot be fixed. We cannot just get cheap electricity again like we had. We theoretically could, but it would take concerted willpower by the government and industry and business. It would take years to get Eskom back where it was, probably a decade. And that was only, that would only be with 100% dedicated effort. So Glencore's efficient. Merafe's very efficient. But everywhere you turn, they're getting clipped. You know, the railroads don't work. The ports don't work. The electricity doesn't work. If it does, it's so high priced. And now that we've given China the edge, they know how to produce ferrochrome. They've taken it to new levels. So the latest technology China's using because they invested in the CAPEX. And shipping is the cheapest way of moving things. It's even cheaper than a pipe. So China can take all that chrome on barges, cost them almost nothing to get across the water. And the way they unload it, the way they transport it to the smelters, I don't think we could ever get that competitive edge back. I think we've lost it. And this sounds catastrophic. I so hope I'm wrong, but I don't see how we can make our furnaces economic. It's devastating. Like ArcelorMittal, you know, it took so much work from the government and industry to build up this iron ore and steel industry. And there we had magnificent iron ore, the cheapest, easy to get deposits. Maybe not quite the cheapest, but pretty easy to get to. We had great infrastructure, so we could transport it from Sishen. We built pretty much state-of-the-art steel plants in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, even the 80s. But by the 90s, we saw that changing. And steel needs infrastructure. And something our steel needed more was growth in infrastructure. You know, ISCOR was able to survive because we were building so many mines. But when we stopped building mines and started closing mines, when we start deindustrializing like we've been doing for literally 25 years nonstop, our policies have geared themselves towards deindustrialization. So there's just no hope for ArcelorMittal that I can see. And as well run as Merafe and Glencore's ferrochrome smelters here, yeah, they're death knells out there. We just can't compete.
And the South32 smelter in Mozambique, same story. I mean, that to me is a crazy story where Eskom buys the power from Cabora Bassa and sells it back to South32 at a price that makes it uneconomic for them to produce any longer. So it just sounds crazy. You've got a third party. There you've got the hydropower right on your doorstep, but because a third party is involved, You are now uneconomic, and the impact on that, on the Mozambican economy, is going to be huge.
Alec, if anybody wants to take a quote out of this half hour you and I have just done, they got to back up about 5-6 minutes where you said, gee, Pete, can't these governments just take a notepad and a pencil and have two columns and write down what are all the pluses I'm getting from this policy and what will be the negatives if I change it? Yeah, you don't need a degree. You don't need an MBA. Do you need all these consultants and advisors? And I worry is that's what is making these governments do these stupid things. It's someone whistling in their ear that either has vested interests in the alternative, or they just want to curry government's favor and get a big kickback. I don't know, but someone must be blabbing nonsense in these governments' ear, because they make them so determined to follow through policies that we can all see make no sense for the country, make no sense for the people, make no sense for job creation, that they only lead to loss of jobs.
If you take that one step further, you would presume that anybody with any sense of honor and nobility would be acting in an honorable way as well on behalf of the people who put them there. But when you overlay corruption, which unfortunately one is finding increasing evidence of, then even if you, even the good guys, even the people who are trying to do the right thing, on the one hand, they're being badly advised. On the other hand, they might be like that former Mozambican finance minister who went to jail because of the Credit Suisse story. If you remember the fishing boats and the loan never came into the fishing boats. It just went to quite a few people who actually had the ability to steal the money. And as a consequence of that, he went to jail, but he was a bad guy. But you would hope that most of the rest are actually good people just being badly advised, but badly advised by the, what did Warren Buffett call them? The super helpers.
Yeah. You know what? If they were incorrectly advised, there's a cure for that. All they have to do is broadcast the factors that led to that decision. And before making a decision, say, I'm thinking of making this decision. Here's why. And boy, there's no better correcting mechanism I've ever seen than a free and open press. You know, that makes us all better. Say what you think and why you think it. And say, if you guys know better, I'm open. Here's my phone number. Here's my door, my address. I'm open. Because that information has always been out there. It's like now we can go into AI and Google and we can usually get the information we need. But it's always been there. Before we had Google, you had a press. Just stayed out on a podium in public view. This is why I'm thinking of making this decision, but I'm open to factors. I'm open to comment telling me where I'm right or wrong or can make a better decision. But they don't do it. It shows they don't want it. They've made up their mind for some other reason and they're not letting us in on it. So nothing genuine about that. Nothing good about that. Nothing open.
It's so tragic because both of us are old enough to remember the transition in the 90s. And I remember meeting for the very first time people who became incredibly famous as politicians and how humble they were and how dedicated they were and how these ANC struggle veterans were going to change South Africa for the better, how they were never going to become arrogant and think that they know everything. But it just appears as though, well, that old story about power corrupting and Lord Acton's absolute power corrupting, absolutely. Before we go, though, let's just end off with Impala Platinum, because here I need your help. Please explain to me, when a company makes a bigger dividend payment than the earnings that it has produced. Now, I know they had good cash flows, so they're paying out most of their cash flows, but it's usually the dividend is covered by earnings at least one time, often more than one time, and especially in mining. What is happening there, or what am I missing?
Man, Alec, I was hoping you wouldn't find a big gap that I've got, and that is it. I saw that. And I haven't pursued it at all. I don't know. It didn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And if anything, Impala survived two near-death experiences. We know one was buying American Palladium at the peak, paying a high price. We called it a Stillwater Light, but it wasn't a Stillwater Light because it was $1 billion instead of $2.5 billion. So it was a Stillwater Light, but that was huge for Impala. And then the second near fatal decision was taking over the Baffa King when Paul Dunn at Northam had managed to really, really ramp the price out of Impala's hands, and they had to pay a crazy high price to get it. And yeah, it's timing, you know, just as they paid, the PGM sector was falling. And look, Paul Dunn still had to write off $4 billion on that. And he was the winner. So you can extrapolate what the loser was. I don't know. And there's a couple analysts out there that explained it pretty clear. And I just haven't paid any attention for it. I still shake my head. This recent burst in the platinum price and rhodium have really saved Impala. And I think somebody was under pressure to get that dividend. I don't know who he was catering to, but a prudent company wouldn't have paid it, but he did. And I don't know the reason why. I haven't even gone through any of the financials on it, Alex. So I'm pleading pass on that one, please.
I'm sure they've got their reasons, or they will argue their reasons, but it's one of those basic laws of economics and basic laws of companies. Don't pay out more money than you earn, even though they might say, well, it's all accounting and actually we did earn more because we had cash flows. Whatever. Peter Major, it's fabulous talking to you on a Wednesday afternoon. Thank you for joining us again and for enlightening us with your experience and wisdom. I look forward to next week. Peter is with Modern Corporate Solutions. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.